Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Positively Trek. My name is Barry DeFord, and with me, as always, is the one, the only, Dan Gunther. Dan, how you doing today?
Not too bad, Barry. I'm feeling particularly villainous this morning. I feel like twirling my non-existent mustache and maybe crying havoc and letting slip the dogs of war or something. How about yourself?
You know, I'm doing very well, and we're definitely hot off the heels of the Khan miniseries that we watched, and I have to say, in hindsight, really, really enjoyed. I have a little bit of highway time coming up ahead here, and I may or may not still have the entire season run downloaded on my phone, and I may or may not listen to the whole thing again. I've got about 8 hours, 9 hours of driving in total ahead of me. So you know what? Might as well.
Why not?
It'll keep me awake.
I'm curious to hear from you how a re-listen goes with that, you know, given the, you know, kind of mystery aspects of the plot and the revelations at the end, how, you know, knowing those going in, how that affects the enjoyment of it. I'd love to know that. That's cool.
Yeah, I'll let you know on how it goes. But yes, feeling a little extra villainous right now, mainly that kind of sympathy for the devil that we can sometimes have. If I was to go outside of Star Trek, I think probably, and unfortunately, this has kind of gone down that kind of alt-right pipeline in a bad way, but when Heath Ledger's Joker first appeared on screen, I think a lot of people were very captivated by his performance, and he kind of became this villain that you're like, is he 100% wrong about some of these things? Or, you know, is he, you know, does he actually, because he would capture your attention. And I think that's not, he's not the first or the only or anything like that. But I think it kind of brought that, that villain you hate to kind of love, and then maybe even love to love, sort of feeling back into vogue, right? We've had villains like that in the past, and just going through the Khan series, you and I both were talking and started talking about other Star Trek villains that we were like, I didn't really hate this guy. And I think, you know, the sympathetic portrait that we get of Khan gives us an insight into some of these other villains of Star Trek, because Star Trek villains do sometimes just come into like the jilted, revenge-driven bad guy or the careerist badmiral. But there are characters that show up quite a bit as well who, you know, they give them a very good tragic backstory, or at least they make an attempt at it. And I want to kind of give those devils their due, shall we say. What do you think about this premise, Dan? And do you think you've got enough juice up there to give me some good Star Trek villains?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've got, it's funny because you have a list here and I have a list that is like 90% similar to the ones that you picked, but you've got a few that I don't, and I've got at least one that you don't. So I think we're going to have some interesting discussions here. But yeah, the whole villain aspect, it's kind of funny. For a while there, it almost seemed like Hollywood fell in love with the anti-hero, right? We had, you know, Breaking Bad and The Sopranos and shows like that. And that kind of almost felt to me like feeding off of the Heath Ledger Joker thing. Like it kind of marked a little shift. And, you know, Star Trek's never really jumped into the anti-hero thing, with one exception, I would say Georgiou in Section 31.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit of a swing and miss with that one. Kind of, you know, we'll see what history says about that. But I'd be interested, just kind of as a little side thing, seeing Star Trek do the anti-hero treatment. I don't know if there'd be much appetite for that. There's kind of pushback against that a little bit with the utopian future. But that said, there are so many villains in Star Trek that have that gray area. And while they're not necessarily anti-heroes or anything like that, there are definitely villains that give you more more to play with and more to think about than your average villain. There are, of course, lots that fall in the category of, they're just a villain and they're irredeemable. But I like that there's a few we can choose from that go against that.
Yeah, they tread into some awkward territory. And upon rewatches of all of these, now, of course, I didn't watch all of these before the episode we are recording now, but so some of this is kind of coming from memory. But yeah, dear listener and viewer, if we have missed, we're going to go through here, obviously, if we have missed someone and missed someone we probably have, please make sure that you add any love to hate villains or hate to love or love to love villains in as well. So the premise basically is they could have elements like, so villains that make you feel sympathy towards them ultimately. And so this could be them having elements of a tragic backstory. Maybe their tragedy comes midway through their story as well. Maybe they become more three-dimensional as we get to know them, and that's why we find them a sympathetic villain. Or they just chewed the scenery so well, you can't forget them. And obviously, Ricardo Montalban's performance in The Wrath of Khan and Space Seed, that's why he would get put here, but we just did a number of episodes about Khan, so we're not going to talk about Khan today, except just exactly this moment, and now we'll move on. So my first villain, and this one I get mainly because I did feel a certain level of sympathy, but I felt it was kind of a bit of a half-baked sympathy, would be Krall from Star Trek Beyond. First of all, I think Idris Elba is an amazing actor who was wildly underutilized. But tell me about that with the three villains of the Star Trek JJ verse, all extremely well accomplished actors playing villains who did get to chew the scenery to some degree, but I really feel like not enough was done. But being, you know, kind of, you know, abandoned by your Federation, by being, you know, cast aside and very much left to cook in your own anger. I mean, there are some Khan-esque SETI Alpha 5 elements to this character. I think he has a right to be angry. I just feel very much like in the time that he would have had to muse on his plight, he doesn't allow himself to become something anything more than just a fierce animalistic villain who kind of gets what he deserves in the end for the actions that he has. Mm-hmm. So I think they could have done more with Krall ultimately, and I feel like they could have let Idris Elba explore the character a little bit more. But I feel like the three JJ films really are played like a ride. I remember the motorbike scene better than I remember many of the things that Krall had to say, honestly, other than maybe his Federation logs. Those seemed pretty good ultimately. Yeah. But otherwise, yeah, I want to feel sympathy for Krall. I think that's it. And his final face, that angry, frustrated, frozen expression, really makes me feel like he got done dirty.
Yeah, I was really fascinated when I saw Krall on your list because somebody that I hadn't thought of myself, but his character really is the victim, I think, of the way the story was told. Like, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff there, and I think there's some really interesting themes to play with as far as sympathy for him and why he is the way he is. But unfortunately, they told that story through that way of telling, which is that mystery box, right? We have to have this mystery up until the very end. So at the very end of the film, you realize, oh, he's a former captain. Oh, this happened to him. Oh, all of this. So you kind of get that all dumped on you. And you're like, you know, if we'd have followed that story from the beginning, what if that film, and I, worst form of criticism is like, this is how I think the film should have gone. But imagine, you know, starting Star Trek Beyond with something from his time in his prime as a Starfleet captain. And then you kind of see that turn. So he becomes that monster. I don't know. I think that would be really fascinating. I think there'd be a lot more sympathy for that character if they told the story differently.
So actually, I'm also going to do precisely what you just did as well and say that had they have backed off of the hyper energetic, you know, next thing, mystery box style, if they would have revealed him almost pretty much at the beginning and had Kirk try to rehabilitate him, had Kirk try to reincorporate him and Krall to actually take the effort to try and then tragically fail from his augmentation and his frustration, that would have made him such a sympathetic character. And I think Idris Elba, I think about his character in like The Wire and stuff like that. Like he has range, or in Luther, Lufa, right? If you've seen his British detective series, like he has range. He can show pain. He can show that level of struggle and attempt at redemption. And they basically gave him nothing to do. So this is definitely not a knock against Mr. Elba. This is a slow the story down and let's take some time to really pull through it. So that's my first crack at the sympathetic villains. Dan, would you like to bring the next one to the fore, or shall we go down my list?
I'm kind of changing the order of mine now because I think this one fits interestingly in with the crawl story here. So my next one is actually from Star Trek Voyager, and we're speaking of Starfleet captains who became monsters. Captain Rudy Ransom of the USS Equinox.
I had him not written. I had him, but I didn't write him down. Good.
You talking about like Kirk trying to spend the film rehabilitating him or bringing him back strikes me as what Janeway did with Ransom. Nice. Over the course of that two-parter in Voyager. And this is one who does ultimately step back from the brink, although the damage he has done is, you know, apparent and can't be fixed by him. But he does kind of come back to the light a little bit right at the end, right? So I think he's an interesting villain. There's the whole aspect of him killing and using these aliens to power his ship. Now, I'm not excusing that. I'm not saying that was anything that is at all excusable. But when he tells the story of how they were thrown into the Delta Quadrant in a ship much less prepared for that than Voyager was. And Voyager wasn't even all that prepared for it, but this little science ship alone, constantly under attack, losing, I think he said, like 2/3 of his crew in the first month or something like that. It's been a long time since I've seen those episodes, but something along those lines. You can't help but feel bad for the guy, but obviously never excuse what he has done and what he has ordered his crew to do and set them on the path for, regardless of him coming back to the side of the angels at the end a little bit. But he's someone that always struck me as definitely someone earning a bit of sympathy, if not redemption, because he can't earn redemption ultimately.
No, you're right. And I didn't end up picking him mainly because I just didn't want my list to be so incredibly long. But what I really thought about was like the tragedy of the Batavia or something, right? Ships that get lost at sea in like our history, you'll often see the surviving crew resorting to absolutely horrifying things in order to stay alive in the unforgiving vastness of the Pacific Ocean, specifically, usually times that by several trillion, and you've got the Delta Quadrant. So you're right, like in some way you're like, you're doing an awful and terrible thing that is very unredeemable, but also your brain has been very cooked by some horrible circumstances, and your desire to survive and to have your crew survive has shaped you in a way that unfortunately you're gone. And that's kind of it. So actually, Ransom and Crawl actually kind of parallel each other a little, don't they?
Yeah. Not a connection I would have made before, but you were talking about him there, just like clicked it in my mind. That's cool.
That's impressive. Yeah. Well, let's stay with Voyager. How about, and I'm going to say that in some ways it isn't really my sympathy for her. It's my sympathy for the characters who interacted with her. And that would be Seska. Seska was, you know, obviously one of the converts, the Maquis from the Valjean, who comes over and joins the Voyager crew, but never fully integrates comparatively. And I think you can really see that with her interaction with B'Elanna, back and forth. And I think where it really comes down to it is my sympathy for her comes when Chakotay goes back in time. And he interacts with her and she discovers basically what her future is going to be and just how desperately she tries to alter the future. And I don't think Chakotay or Torres would have, if they knew they were going to die to have to have someone else live, they would have done it. Seska's choice to be like, no, you need to die. If I'm going to die, then I'll, and I can kill you or you cannot exist. That's fine. I want to live. Really hammers it down, right? She is a great betrayal, and makes the makes the story interesting. And again, I haven't seen Voyager those episodes like maybe more than twice, and that was a decade and some ago. But I remember feeling very much like, oh man, Seska cut those guys deep, like deep. And yeah. So that kind of makes her a sympathetic character, not for my sympathy towards her, but like my sympathy towards the characters who thought they knew her, if that's fair.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Seska, for nothing else, I think, inspires one of my favorite lines in Voyager, which I think was Chakotay. Yeah, no, sorry. Yeah, it was Chakotay talking about his crew on the Valjean when it's revealed that Seska was a Cardassian operative. And
yeah.
He turns to Tuvok and says, you were working for her. She was working for them. Was anybody on that ship working for me? I don't know. I just love that line. Seska is great. And Martha Hackett.
Oh yeah.
Just choose that scenery as Seska. I don't know. I never felt a ton of sympathy for the character, but at the same time, like, you know, really looking at things from her perspective, like she just honestly thought Janeway was making bad decisions and was going to get everybody killed. So she's like, I'm going to throw my lot in with the Kazon. Maybe not the best judge of character ever, but, you know, the misogynistic brutes who, you know, don't seem to treat her all that well, but whatever. But yeah, fascinating character. I remember really disliking Seska episodes when I first watched it as a young man, but then going back and rewatching Voyager, man, she has so much fun with those scenes and she is a joy to watch.
Yeah. I think that's it too, is she's just good at being bad and you enjoy that. And her level of betrayal is pretty painful. So there's my next volley. We're going to play some bad guy tennis. I've just hit the ball back into your court, bro.
So I'm going to throw one out there who ultimately, I guess, isn't the main villain of his film, but he does kind of serve that role for most of it. That would be the winner of a film, Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. I want to talk a little bit about Cybok. You know, not the worst guy in the world. His whole mission was to take away people's pain, and he genuinely believed he was going to meet God and fulfill this vision of prophecy that he got, basically. And, you know, it turns out that was an evil entity trapped at the center of the galaxy. But, you know, you can't put that all on Cybok. He really thought he was doing the right thing there. And I will say, the best thing, I think, in retrospect about Star Trek V is Lawrence Luckinbill's performance as Cybok. He's charismatic and fun to watch. And there's not a lot about that movie that's fun to watch, but Cybok's not bad. Seriously, if you haven't watched Star Trek V in a while, it is not great, but if you do rewatch it, pay attention to Cybok's character and maybe give him a little bit more of the benefit of the doubt than you have in the past. He's interesting to watch. And another podcast, Trek Untold, recently did an interview with Lawrence Luckinbill, and he talked about what that character meant to him and stuff. And it's really fascinating. There's more depth there than I think people realize.
And I mean, he's reasonable. He gives Kirk his ship back.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, like he's not, I guess that's it, is in terms of a bad guy, he's just an antagonist, I would say, right?
He's a bad guy, but he's not a bad guy.
There you go. Yeah, he's a bad guy, but he's not a bad, yeah, I love it. Perfect. Yeah, I don't have much to say. I haven't seen The Final Frontier since the early 2000s. I'd say we're coming on probably 15 to 20 years at this point. Wow. It's been a long time. But I remember the marshmallow dispenser. I'll never forget that. That was actually the hero of the film for me.
For sure. I hear you. Yeah. I get it.
Yeah. No, but I, you know, that merits a rewatch. Perhaps you and I can Mystery Science Theater 3000, the movie, someday.
It's fun. It's fun to do that for sure. Because that's the only way you can watch it. Sorry for all the fans of Star Trek V out there. It's a movie with some good bits in it, but ultimately it's not a great movie. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I agree. So speaking of maybe, I don't know, I'm really happy they brought her back. And that hints it to everyone. I'm really happy they brought her back. I'm really happy they did what they did and brought her back. But I feel like some of her premise was a little jilted, and that would be Sela. Sela is a character that I quite enjoy, and I think it really comes down to the fact that I just absolutely love Denise Crosby. I think she is a fantastic character. I think that losing Tasha Yar gives us so much, but losing Denise Crosby is kind of like, she is the great what if of Star Trek The Next Generation, right? Had we not have lost her as early, what would have that have done for the entire series? It would have changed everything. And, you know, maybe it's the road less traveled and that made all the difference or something like that. But I'm happy they brought Denise back as Sela, as the daughter of Yar from Yesterday's Enterprise. I just feel like her backstory made it a little weird. And I know they wanted to make that continuity. And as far as I remember, that was actually Denise Crosby's idea. And you know what? If anyone knows better than me, I mean, I guess there is this system of tubes called the internet that we could look at. So I'm kind of going off of half-baked knowledge. But what I like about Sela is the fact that she is so incredibly driven. But she does it, I feel like she really does typify the Romulan ethos of coming out of the shadows, right? The very first time you see her, she literally comes out of the shadows. And that makes her a villain of villains in a lot of cases, and gives her the what I think we could have gotten from other Romulans. But she is played by Denise so incredibly well. And I think about some of the femme fatales, the female villains, and I can only compare her off of, say, like the Duras sisters, who are, you know, they're kind of like very brutish, right, and stuff. And though they're fun, and I have to say, the Duras sisters do destroy the Enterprise D. So, you know, I give them an honorable mention. But what I liked about Sela was the fact that she was so incredibly driven as a character and single-minded in that approach, which makes her a little one-dimensional, but Denise Crosby plays her so incredibly well that she is a fun villain to watch. She is a bad guy's bad guy, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah, I have so many mixed feelings about Sela.
Right?
because I love Denise Crosby. I love that they brought her back. The backstory and how she came to be, I think, is really interesting and really fascinating. But, like, they just never did anything with it that I kind of wish they'd explored it a little bit more. And I mean, I know she's just a villain who pops up a couple times. There's not really time to explore things, but, you know, what would that have been like growing up in Romulus with her heritage and, like, how she got to where she is? Now, I will say the Star Trek and mostly the Star Trek Defiant comic series that came out since 2022, I think, and ended just, you know, a few months ago, really actually dives into Sela's character quite a bit, and non-canon alarm going off and stuff. but they do some really interesting things with her where she's actually facing off against her father in some parts of it and stuff. It's some pretty cool stuff and stuff that I wish they had done on the TV show or in a film. Like, there was, remember when Nemesis was coming out and it was going to be all about the Romulans and there was going to be a strong female Romulan Starship Commander at some point, like these little leaks were coming out, and all the speculation was like, oh my God, Denise Crosby's coming back as Sela. How cool would that have been, right? Not to like Donatra, great character, loved her, very well acted, but like, yeah, I always wanted more with Sela. And I feel like maybe the convolutedness of her backstory and the kind of weird sci-fi-ishness of it might have been something that made writers want to distance themselves from the character a little, maybe not want to touch that because it's a little like, if you're doing a movie, that's a lot to kind of pile in there for a new viewer to come in and try and understand. So maybe that's why they never approached the character again, but I really would have liked that.
Well, and to some degree, I think that would have pulled from Tom Hardy's attempt at a Captain Kirk clone. I mean, I do feel like...
Or Picard.
Sorry. Yeah. My brain stopped working there. Tom Hardy's attempt at a Picard clone. I think that his performance also kind of missed in that. And I'm not blaming Tom. He's, again, a very good actor. And he really committed to the role. But there was, you're right, a lot of convolution in that story and maybe pulling back from using Sela as that character, or maybe just having made her the primary villain or some kind of redemption arc would have been cooler. And now we're pontificating like we said we wouldn't do, but now we're doing it again. That's Sela. And I think really what it comes down to for me as well is if I think back to my like memories of Star Trek The Next Generation when it was on, I always thought very much like Sela as the blonde Romulan. It was always, there was just something, she stood apart in a lot of ways. And I thought that was always very interesting about her.
Interesting thing about my time watching The Next Generation, just because of when I came into it. I think the first time I ever saw Denise Crosby in Star Trek was as Sela in either Redemption Part 2, because I started watching at the start of season 5, I think. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, in Unification later that season. And Tasha Yar was always just somebody that people talked about with reverent voices. And I never got to see her till way after. So it's kind of a unique way to come to the character a little bit. So I knew Sela before I knew Tasha Yar. It's interesting.
Interesting. Very interesting. I was dumb and didn't know that they were played by the same person.
Oh. I mean, suspension of disbelief. That's a big thing. Yeah.
I was like, wait, what? That's the same person? And yeah. Oh boy.
Awesome.
I always feel the pressure to find the perfect gift for my relatives. In this case, whether you're sending an unforgettable gift or treating yourself to everyday perfection, Omaha Steaks delivers the world's best steak experience. For me, I'm not just into steaks. I like all types of meat. That's why I'll usually get the Winter's Best Seller Pack. It comes with juicy fillets, chicken breast, pork chops, and even burgers. Omaha Steaks offers unrivaled quality and variety, and every bite is backed by their 100% guarantee. A family-owned company with over 100 years of experience in the meat industry. Save big on unforgettable gifts with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide and earn an extra 20% off select favorites during their cyber sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code YUM at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. Go to omahasteaks.com to get 50% off site-wide plus an extra 20% off select favorites and more limited-time deals during their cyber sale. And use promo code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details. A big thanks to our advertiser, Omaha Steaks.
As always, Positively Trek is brought to you by its Patreon supporters, including Joyce Mirren, Brandy Jackala, Christina DeClercq-Zalagi, John Guppy, Out of Memory, Patrick Carlin, and Ricky Long. If you'd like to support the podcast, visit patreon.com/positivelytrek. You can join at any level and enjoy early access to episodes, ad-free episodes, episode shoutouts, executive producer credits, and more. Again, that's patreon.com/positivelytrek. Thank you so much to those of you supporting us. We truly do appreciate it. And now, back to the show. I have one here that's not on the list, and I know earlier I said that Star Trek's never dipped into the anti-hero thing, really. I think this character actually comes a little bit close now that I'm kind of thinking about it. And that would be another Cardassian hero or villain turned hero. And Damar, I think, is someone that needs to be mentioned a little bit here. Started out as just a lackey to Dukat, kind of like a background actor that they did close-ups on a few too many times. And you're like, huh, am I supposed to be paying attention to this guy? And then, became a very villainous character, kind of the face of Cardassian fascism and racism and just really like despicable character during the occupation of Deep Space Nine by the Dominion and all of that stuff. Kills one of our beloved characters on Deep Space Nine when he murders Zial, and then has this wonderful arc towards the end of the series where he realizes the stranglehold that the Dominion has on Cardassia and becomes kind of a folk hero for the Cardassian resistance movement and ultimately gives his life in his attempt to free Cardassia, and along the way gets a few lessons in what the Dominion is doing now is very similar to what you yourself did. And you can see he kind of absorbs those lessons a little bit. And it kind of shows that, you know, I maybe not anyone can be redeemed or anyone can learn lessons from their past, but he certainly can. And I'm curious to see what would have happened if that character would have kept going. But also I understand that moralistically and storytelling wise, he had to pay the price for his earlier hubris, and that's how Western storytelling works. And he ultimately did give his life in a way that was very satisfying. So I love Damar.
Dan, that was great. And I don't know how to respond to that other than, firstly, how did I miss Damar? Oh my gosh. Like, come on. You're right. And I think maybe the reason why I missed him is he just sits as a hero to me.
That's the thing. Yeah, we end on a note of hero. So yeah. He didn't occur to me very early on either. It was very late in the process that I was like, oh, wait, Damar.
But you're right. He becomes more three-dimensional as we get to know him. And your treatment of him in the sense that, yeah, like he does some reprehensible things and ultimately does have to kind of die for those things. And those are kind of irredeemable in a lot of ways. But at the same time, he is made to see his folly and he turns around and ends up doing the right thing. Wow. That's a really good way of putting it. And actually, again, it's a testament to the Deep Space Nine writers for taking those characters and turning them like they did. And I think in reality, one can hope that that does happen with certain people who might have done bad things in the past. I think one of my biggest connections to that was I actually got to speak at a golf tournament of all places with my mom went to a corporate golf tournament near Pigeon Lake in Alberta, if anyone knows where that is. And one of my mom's coworkers' dads, who has since passed away, was German. And I speak conversational, or at least I spoke conversational German back in the day. And I wound up talking with this guy who, as we were chatting in kind of broken German and mostly English, he eventually started talking to me about the fact that he was in the German army in the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget what he said. And I'm not going to put on his accent or anything like that. But he had said that he had served in Rommel's Afrika Corps in the Wehrmacht. And he got dysentery and had to get pulled. And then when he was in an Italian hospital and he wound up getting captured by the Canadians. Like basically they just showed up at the hospital he was in after the Germans had left. And they were like, hi, we're Canadians and you're our prisoners now. And they're like, we're all sick and in bed. So hi, that kind of thing. Right. But here's what he said, because I said, well, you were just fighting for your country. And he said, never mistake what I did. I remember he put his finger in my face and he said, I may not have fully agreed with Hitler or the Nazis, But every time I took an objective, whether I agreed or not, I took it for Hitler. Every time I took a town, I took it for Hitler. I could wring my hands and say how bad I was for helping out and that this was a bad cause, but the fact that I did it made me bad, and I should have shot myself.
Wow.
And I was like, fix it, Otto. Like, I couldn't believe it. Like, it was a profound moment. And I was 20. I was about 20 years old when he told me that. And I remember thinking, like, wow, they were just fighting for their country argument just was hollowed out by an actual veteran of that army. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a Damar in that where he got a chance to fully see the other side of it. Mm-hmm. I'm glad he didn't shoot himself for the fact that he was able to tell me that, but I also understand where he was coming from. And we don't condone that sort of thing no matter what. But at the same time, yeah, I think that's the Damar element, which I am now going to coin. Thanks to you, Dan, for bringing that up. That was a exceptionally good treatment of Damar.
Well, I mean, thank the writers of Deep Space Nine, because, man.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna switch gears a little bit, and we're gonna talk about the most jilted sibling with massive daddy issues, and that is Lore.
Not Tom Riker. Sorry.
Oh goodness.
Sorry.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's another. That's like if Sela and Lore were one character in some ways, I guess. Kind of. Hey.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Anyway,
Lore. She's a tough little ship. I like Lore. I mean, honestly, it basically boils down to the many stylings of Brent Spiner playing so many characters in Star Trek. But I often found that even way back when we were watching the first run of Star Trek The Next Generation, or at least watching the syndication, and, you know, only Deep Space Nine was just kind of starting and stuff like that, I always appreciated Lore as that foil to Data, right? I kind of think of him a little bit like a Lucifer character of like, no, I will choose to be bad. I will choose to defy. I want to be the other side of this. I don't find it interesting to be a good guy. And I will actually play on the better senses of others. And I think about how Lore especially did that little Borg Hugh faction so incredibly dirty in them trying to build themselves something outside of the collective, thanks to... I mean, honestly, he could have done so much more. He could have actually defeated the Borg, ultimately, had he have utilized what Hugh was actually trying to get and what those freed Borg were trying to get at. I think they could have actually mounted probably the most effective resistance against the Borg collective and reimagined the Borg in a much more redemptive way. But no, Lore was just interested in what he was interested in. He just wanted what he wanted, and that was that. I also think his exchanges with Dr. Noonien Soong always did just come off to me as the angry, ignored, jilted son who wasn't the golden boy and wanted something more and really just wanted daddy to say, I love you. And that was it. And he never really gets that in that first run.
Yeah. Literally turned off and put on a shelf and then a better version of him built.
Yeah.
Like what's that going to do to your psyche, right? Positronic or otherwise. Lore has his ups and downs for me. I feel like, the Borg two-parter, for example, I hate Lore in those episodes. And I mean, you're meant to, he's the bad guy, I guess, but, I ultimately like how Lore's story was resolved in Star Trek Picard. I thought that was kind of brilliant rather than, you know, turning him off or shutting him away or getting rid of him. Data from that point going forward is basically an amalgamation of, you know, the best parts of Data and the best parts of Lore and Lol and B4 and all of these, right? And I thought that was great. I love that there's redemption there. There's acknowledgement of what made him who he is and that isn't all that he is. I thought there's just something beautiful about that. But at his best, he was fun to watch. I love Brent Spiner just, you know, again, chewing the scenery and just being bad.
For the sake of badness.
Yeah.
You know, I like what you have to say about how Lore didn't ultimately just get cast off. He was, I mean, there was a type of, I mean, Picard had so much to do. They talked so much about change and how our experiences do make us different people and we aren't the same, and accepting and kind of embracing that. And I think that's where, yeah, Data's death, I guess, isn't the death. It's actually, we all kind of die every single day as we change and grow. Like I talk to my students and say, you know, the child that you are now will not be after you graduate, and you will still feel your essential self as yourself, but you won't be who you were. That person is gone. And I like how you talk about that kind of idea of symbiosis, of coming together. And actually, I read a really good book once by Greg Graffin, the lead singer of the band Bad Religion. He actually has a doctorate in zoology, and the book is called Population Wars. And he actually talks about how survival of the fittest and vanquishing, you know, one side against the other actually isn't the way evolution or life actually works. It's the survival of the most symbiotic, who can create mm-hmm. those symbioses. But you have to realize those things change us, right? You look inside the human genome and we've got fossilized viruses in us all the way back. So we are actually something different. I mean, take COVID, for instance. It's part of us now, whether we like it or not, and whether we want to be upset about it or not. It's now in everybody's genome at this point, and it will be from here on in. It has changed us, and it was a violent and terrible process, but it is part of us now. And so, yeah, I like that idea that, but the good part is the best parts get to be amalgamated with that new understanding, that new iteration of Data, for sure.
Well, my final one, this is the last one that I have on my list that's different from yours. And this is a guy that I wanted to talk about when you first mentioned this. This is a person who at first seems to be a friend and is a good guy for a bunch of the run. And then the heel turn comes and we find out that he's actually a villain. This is, again, Deep Space Nine. We've got Michael Eddington, the Maquis traitor from the perspective of Benjamin Sisko, and the freedom fighter folk hero from the perspective of the Maquis. And again, the Maquis are an interesting thing in Star Trek because they're not wrong. They're not always right, but they're not wrong either. And I love that in Star Trek, we see a bit of a discussion, like Harry Kim wrote an editorial when he was at the Academy about the good points that the Maquis had and little things like this that show that, you know, it's not a monolith. Not everybody feels the same way. There's room for dissenting opinions, but when you turn on Starfleet, Starfleet sure turns on you. And, Michael Eddington is just such a great moral quandary, basically, mm-hmm. because, you know, you're on Sisko's side bringing this guy to justice. He betrayed them. He did betray them. He shot Major Kira and took over the station for a few hours. Mm-hmm. Like, he did some bad things, but ultimately his belief in the cause of freedom for the Maquis from the Cardassians, whom, you know, the Federation just delivered to them basically and really did them dirty with a bad treaty. It was a bad treaty. Mm-hmm. There's sympathy there. There's and I mean, ultimately the show kind of goes out of its way to say that maybe Michael Eddington wasn't really bought into the cause so much as his own self-aggrandizement as a folk hero.
Yep.
There's definitely a lot of that, but at the same time, who doesn't want to be a bit of a folk hero from time to time, right? I have some That's sympathy true. For that guy.
And I agree with you. I didn't choose Eddington, mainly because I'm still mad at him. I've always been mad at Eddington because that's exactly it. He gets a whiff of being perhaps some kind of revolutionary folk hero. Mm-hmm. And then he makes himself obsessed.
Yes.
With it, right? He considers himself to be Jean Valjean, right? He considers himself to be this, and then he makes Sisko his project. And by doing that, he loses sight of what the actual fight truly is. Mm-hmm. And that's his greatest flaw as a villain, as a character, is you're right. He gets caught up in his own myth before that myth is written, right? You think about someone like Che Guevara, who I would say is probably one of the most popular revolutionary folk heroes of the 20th century. What are Che Guevara's last words to the man about to kill him? He says, "Take the gun and shoot, coward. You are only killing a man." He didn't care. Like, I don't matter, right? Again, going back to Batman, if you look at Bane, it doesn't matter who we are. What matters is our plan, right? And I think that's where Eddington goes wrong, is he turns Sisko into this project. Because Sisko isn't wrong in all of the ways he sees Eddington, right? Mm-hmm. But then also, I think he brings out the worst in Benjamin Sisko, more so even than Gul Dukat, because I think you begin to realize that the number one thing that can get under Benjamin Sisko's skin is the betrayal of the uniform.
Yes.
Right? And you really do see Avery Brooks is probably one of them, like when he's telling Worf to destroy an entire planet's atmosphere, do some pretty awful stuff, you see Sisko ultimately at his worst, and Eddington brings out the worst in him, because I think the worst is brought out of Eddington because Eddington sees himself as this, and that for me makes me completely not sympathize with him, because he did, not only does he betray his uniform, he betrays his cause, and I just can't forgive him for that. I can't forgive him, and maybe that's what makes him the best, one of the best villains in that sense, is because I gnash my teeth at him because he could have done so much more.
And I mean, the Maquis were destroyed under his leadership.
Yeah.
And I mean, not entirely his fault. I mean, he couldn't predict the Cardassians would ally with a power from the other side of the galaxy and wipe them all out. But still, you know, there's some bad things there for sure. I will say his speech at the end of For the Cause, though, the episode where his betrayal is ultimately revealed, he tells no lies in that speech. That whole, you're like, in some ways you're even worse than the Borg. At least they tell you of their plans to assimilate you, you know, like all this stuff Fair. About the Federation. From a certain point of view, he's not saying anything that's a lie. But yeah. I don't know. He's so much fun to watch. I love the performance of him for sure. I think someday we need to do a whole episode about the Maquis in general. That same episode, there's a great scene on the bridge where they're, you know, staking out and waiting for the Maquis ship to come. And they're talking about Worf's in command and O'Brien and Eddington are there. Eddington's putting on a performance. You don't realize this, but O'Brien starts saying, like, you know, you feel bad for the Maquis because, you know, they lost their homes and blah, blah, blah. And Worf's like, they betrayed their whatever and they should be hunted down and killed. And O'Brien's like, geez, Eddington, what do you think? And he's like, well, if Starfleet tells me to help the Maquis, I'll help them. If Starfleet tells me to hunt down the Maquis, I'll hunt them down. All I have is my duty. Nice performance there, buddy. But it's a great scene that just, I don't know, the Maquis are such an interesting issue that I would love to pick apart.
Yeah, well, let's do it. Coming soon, folks.
Absolutely.
Speaking of characters with an amazing turn of phrase, let's talk about Christopher Plummer, General Chang from the Undiscovered Country. I think we kind of hinted at him last time, and he actually is sort of the inspiration for me for this entire episode, him and one other. I think there is nothing necessarily, like, I don't know, he's not like sympathetic in that way. I think it really just boils down to his exchanges, right? He is the most fun and as constant as the North Star as bad guys go. Good bad guys, I guess you could say in that sense. And so I want to talk a little bit about some of his quotes, and then I'll pass it on to you in that. But first of all, you know, obviously we're looking at the end of the Cold War. So much is happening in terms of detente and perestroika and whatnot. The fact that the Soviet Union is making a big turn. It itself is ultimately betrayed by a coup d'etat that takes place in real history. But I love his first statement, in space, all warriors are cold warriors. Just an absolute brilliant piece. And I mean, that does kind of talk a little bit about Reagan's Star Wars program, the fact that the Cold War was really starting to move into space at that point. The bonk bonk on the head, as the mission log folks would state, was really, really good for me in that. I really enjoyed that. But I would say that probably my absolute favorite, again, comes from history, where he says, indeed, the record shows that Captain Kirk once held the rank of admiral, and that Admiral Kirk was broken for taking matters into his own hands in defiance of regulations of the law. Do you deny being demoted for these charges? Don't wait for the translation. Answer me now. That actually comes from the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the Soviet ambassador is basically shouting at this point and wants answers. And so for me, I just love how they just rip a lot of that movie from history. I would say that as a political statement, The Undiscovered Country, Ring Supreme, and General Chang himself is the ultimate example of a villain from the Cold War.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, the Cuban Missile Crisis connection, I've always loved that they pulled that right from history. So that was actually the U.S. ambassador, Adlai Stevenson.
Oh, to the Soviet. Yeah.
Yeah. So the quote from history is to the Soviet ambassador Zorin. So, yeah. Stevenson says, do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation. Yes or no?
Beautiful.
And Christopher Plummer's rendition of the Star Trekified version of that. It's just beautiful. Yeah. Just so good. I remember Star Trek VI was actually the first Star Trek movie that I saw in theaters. And that scene was just so good, even not knowing at the time the historical context of it. Christopher Plummer just does some amazing stuff with the Chang character, the Shakespearean quotes, mm-hmm. all of that. The thing about his character, though, that I appreciate the most is... I guess not so much garnering sympathy, but he's kind of a version of Kirk that Kirk could look at and say, you know, there, but for the grace of God, go I, basically, yeah. Because Kirk is feeling many of the same things Chang is feeling, an end to the neutral zone, an end to what he's known all his life, this hostility between the Federation and the Klingons, and the fear of the future that lies beyond that, the fear of the undiscovered country that lies beyond peace with the Klingons. And Kirk could easily have gone the way Chang went and did the things that he was being framed for, right? Mm-hmm. Attacking and assassinating the Klingon High Chancellor, all of this stuff to you know, set things, to keep the universe the way he is comfortable in. That's what Chang ultimately does. And no sympathy for me for that, for sure. But, you know, that's got to be something that makes Kirk wake up in a cold sweat every night, wondering how far away was Kirk from doing that sort of thing? Because he certainly felt some of the same things.
Yeah. And I think the respect that Chang shows for, you know, humanity, right? Or you know, humans specifically, right? He has that Shakespearean fascination, and his exchange with members of the crew. You know, there's an honor that Chang brings to it, and a bit of a reverence, right? You know, that idea, and maybe that kind of comes all the way back to like balance of terror, right? This idea that sometimes your enemy can kind of respect you in certain aspects, and that relationship that they have, yeah, that relationship's changing and going from adversary to ally, and having the respect as adversaries, you know, will you be able to translate that over into respect as allies and whatnot? I mean, there's a lot to unpack with him, but I think my favorite quote would be when Chang is gaslighting about Captain Kirk. He says some stuff that my question always is, and this could go to maybe other Starfleet captains as well, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being completely wrong and 10 being completely right, How wrong is Chang here? Captain Kirk's views and motives are indeed the very heart of the matter. This officer's record shows him to be an insubordinate, undisciplined, career-minded opportunist with a history of violating the chain of command wherever it suits him. There is a lot of violation of the chain of command whenever it suits for Kirk, Janeway, Sisko, sometimes even Picard, right? It's an interesting point to be made.
We like our heroes to you know, be a little bit of a bad boy or a bad girl, I guess, as well.
Cavalier. Yeah.
Cavalier, a little bit, you know, and maybe knowing more than the brass back home does, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a bit of that for sure.
So I wonder how much respect might be in that quote deep down as well, right?
It could be, yeah. Look what this guy can get away with.
I don't know. He could and should actually probably have his own episode. So maybe this is just a little chicky nuggy dip into what I would consider to be one of the most insubordinate, unprincipled, career-minded opportunists in all of Star Trek, who violates the chain of command whenever it suits him, and that would be Gul Dukat. I love this character.
Yes.
Hands down, I love this character. And not because I agree with really anything that he does. But I love the fact that he dips his toe into redemption on several occasions, and much like Lore, chooses the bad path, right? There's times that he has to team up with Sisko. There's times where he does his own thing, right? When he steals that bird of prey and fights his own tiny little Lore, and you're almost like, is Dukat going to turn around here? Like, what's going on? And
speaking of becoming a folk hero, right?
Right.
That toyed with that for a little bit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The fact that he is constantly looking for validation from those he has wronged shows that to some degree there is this little bit of conscience that's just trying to claw its way out of him in so many cases. And I think he very much respects, reveres, and in a weird way kind of loves Benjamin Sisko. Right. He even their last exchange with each other. Right. He really kind of I'm of the paw wraiths. Right. And you know, you're of the prophets and stuff like that. Honestly, that aside, he does kind of have this moment of like, you know, we've had our wins and our losses, both of us. Right. We've traded these shots with each other, and now it's going to end, kind of thing. But there's so much.
Admit it, Benjamin, I've won. Like, he wants that aggrandizement, right?
Yeah. He's always seeking that aggrandizement. And I think it basically comes from the fact that he knows he's wrong. He knows he's actually the bad guy. Somewhere deep down, he understands that. But at the same time, it makes him so incredibly interesting because he goes in so many different directions, right? Even when he takes the dictatorship, right? When he allies with the Dominion, you know, deep down, Dukat thinks he's doing everybody a big favor, and he's not. He's so megalomaniacal. But I think that's what makes him interesting, is because baseball references, because I always think of him holding Sisko's baseball, he throws some pretty good curveballs, ultimately. And I think that's what makes Dukat such an interesting three-dimensional villain in so much. And honestly, you know, we've been talking for about an hour, and I feel like we could talk for another hour about Gul Dukat. So I'll let you kind of give a treatment of this guy as well.
Yeah. Yeah, we should talk for another hour in a new episode about Gul Dukat. I absolutely love this character as well. Mark Alaimo just is incredible in this role. From that very first time you see him in Deep Space Nine, right? Where he walks into what is now Sisko's office, and it's like, a week ago, this was my office. Like, you just know, like, the history of that character and tying it to Deep Space Nine. And over the course of the seven seasons, we see more of that history, and we learn more of his past and his dealings with Bajor. And yeah, there are times where you feel like he's going to be an ally. He's going to be, you know, how many times do we see him and Sisko kind of teaming up, like with the Maquis episodes? Yeah. But ultimately, he can't help being what he is, which is a megalomaniacal wannabe dictator. And that's what he ultimately ends up as. And there's some debate to be had about how his character was handled in the last couple seasons, basically going to like, no, he's 100% evil and is now, you know, allied with the devil, basically. Maybe a little bit, as we say, bonk bonk on the head, but I almost feel like there was a kind of a pushback from the producers a little bit where people were liking Ducat and they're like, okay, no, we've got to like be clear. He is the bad guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I still enjoy those episodes. Maybe wasn't the best turn for his character, but I just, his performance is so good that, you know, whatever they did with Ducat, it was just such a pleasure to watch him on screen. Just that he could in turns charm you and then in the next breath make your skin crawl.
Yes.
And that is what an incredible actor to be able to do that.
Yeah. Well, and you had mentioned this, that Mark Alaimo will assert that he is the main character, his character is the main character of, yep, of Deep Space Nine in general. And I guess, yeah, I mean, I've seen, you know, we both have seen Mark Alaimo, you know, on the stage at Star Trek conventions and stuff, and he brings that charisma wherever he goes mm-hmm, in real life as well, just as a person. And it's fun to watch him talk about his character. It's fun to watch him pontificate. I think he gives a really good message ultimately as well through his bad guy persona. He actually really brings a good reflective message in the end. So yeah, let's talk about him more. So any last kind of honorable mentions, any other yes ands? I've got one. Any other ones that you got for me here?
I mean one of the ones that popped into my head, and I didn't mention him because he's in turns both a villain and an ally, and it's kind of muddies the water a bit. John Delancey's Q. I mean, kind of the impish, maybe not villain, but certainly antagonist at times. I just recently rewatched All Good Things, which I think is his single best performance in the Star Trek franchise. And the trial scene with Picard, where he is, you know, taunting Picard and making fun of him, but at the same time giving him little nudges in the right direction to help him figure this whole thing out. Yeah. Just such a brilliant scene. John Delancey, when he's being the most threatening and villainous, he's so good at that. But when he's also being just impish and charming, equally fun to watch. And the way his story was ultimately wrapped up, with Picard asking him, you know, why me? Why all of this attention on me? And he said, even gods have their favorites, and you were always mine. I love that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I didn't include Q mainly because he isn't quite this bad guy's bad guy. Like he doesn't. Mm. He isn't insidious in his evil, right? He's got a, I don't know, he's
puckish,
got a
different, or yeah, Loki-ish. He's just an impish being.
Yeah, exactly. But my honorable mention actually is from Strange New Worlds. And, you know, the somewhat reimagining of the Gorn that has been done in Strange New Worlds in season 2 and in season 3. We really get a unredeemable, very scary, brutish, horror-driven creature, right? Monsters, really, in a lot of ways, that do some pretty horrible stuff. That all gets turned on its head in Terrarium. And seeing Ortegas work as a fantastic team with this Gorn pilot and her situation, her injury, and the way she treats Ortegas, you really do kind of get a, I don't know, it would have given me more whiplash if it wasn't portrayed and produced as well as it was. I feel like I actually kind of got to know this Gorn pilot better than Krall in a lot of ways. And they had less time to flesh out this character. But what they give her to do makes her more redeemable.
And that's incredible given that like she only says agree or disagree. Like,
right?
That's incredible. That's so good.
Yeah, disagree when she's like running, when Ortegas is running out. No, you're right. The less is more aspect of the portrayal of that Gorn character. And I think the way they get Ortegas to interact with her and using Ortegas's kind of, you know, kind of cowboyish, tomboyish, I don't know what you want to say, that kind of charm that she has really gives a personality to this otherwise very unredeemable species at this point, right? There's nothing that I like about the Gorn except for this pilot. everything else is gross and terrible. They're kind of like cicadas now, apparently, too. Like it's a strange kind of way to reimagine the Gorn, but I have to say Terrarium sits in probably in one of my top 20 episodes now of Star Trek. It's very enjoyable, and I think it is because it takes this whole turn, and it maybe in certain ways gives you that the enemy's story is a lot like mine, even in such a vastly different portrayal. So that's my little honorable mention that I'm glad that we gave the Gorn something positive, and the way they did it, the way they handled it, was good. And then the tragedy too, right? The fact that they just shoot her immediately, because there is like, what have all of their experiences with the Gorn have been so far? They've been horrifying. So yeah. I wouldn't wait. If I saw a Gorn, I'd shoot it immediately. So yeah, no, I think the way that whole episode was framed and put together was genius. It was very well done.
Yeah, agree.
Agree.
I love that episode. It's definitely a gem, I think, in the Strange New Worlds milieu of episodes. But the performance also by the I guess puppeteer or the person in the suit, even but also Melissa Navia's performance opposite that, and she does an amazing job in that episode of I hate the word, but I can't think of a different one, humanizing the enemy in that way. Brilliant and beautifully done, for sure.
Yeah, she and Mark Hamill are now up in the top of like actors who can work well with puppets.
Yes. And Michael Caine.
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah. Forgot about Michael Caine. Beautiful.
He plays puppets. That movie like the at no moment does he betray the fact that he's working with Muppets. He throws himself into that role. We're talking about the Muppet Christmas Carol, by the way.
Absolutely.
Anyway, love that film.
Beautiful. Well, I think that about does it. And I don't think that does it. I think we've left a couple of loose ends. I think there's more to talk about, but, we also have livings to keep and have to go do stuff now, I'm sure. But thank you for joining us on this little trip down the road of evil with some of our best Star Trek villains out there who we just love to love or hate to love or whatever you want to say about it. Sympathetic villains. Obviously, if you've got more people to bring up, definitely jump on our Star Trek Facebook page to weigh in on whatever that might be or whomever that might be. And if you want to riff off of anything we've already spoken about, you can do the same as well. You can send us an email. You can support us on Patreon. All of those wonderful things. But in the meantime, though you may be delving in the evil and the badness that Star Trek has to offer, always remember, folks, stay positive.
Positively Trek is produced and edited by me, Dan Gunther, and co-produced by Barry DeFord on Treaty 8 territory, the home of the Beaver, Cree, Dene, and Métis people, whose histories, languages, and cultures we respect. We acknowledge the many First Nations, Métis, and Inuit who have lived in and cared for these lands for generations.
See you.